This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode number 121 of the Ridge Hunter Outdoors Podcast. Before I get into this week's episode, I actually just got in from a turkey hunt. Tyler drew first season, so we got out on opening day today here in the South Zone in Illinois, and we got it done. He got it done, I should say. I was just there running the camera. We got it all on film. We had a really good hunt early off the roost. We had birds all over us, like five or six toms and a couple jakes out there as well with some hens. And then we tried to stalk them after they got across the field and the fog kind of rolled in, so we felt like we had good cover. We went across the field, and then a coyote came bouncing out of the timber and scared all the birds away. So we went to a second spot. In the second spot, we saw some birds where he thought they might be, and we put a stalk on them and ended up being 15, 20-yard shot for him. So that was a really cool hunt. It was a lot of fun. You guys are going to get to see that over on our YouTube channel, hopefully by the end of this week. So make sure you stay tuned. Go over there and subscribe. Hit the notification bell so you know when all of that stuff comes out. Like I said on last week's episode, the turkey hunting videos, there's not going to be any schedule to them. It's just whenever we get them, we'll put them out. I think I'm the next one with the tag, and that's third season, so we won't have anything from second season or the rest of first season, really. I know Nate and Kaylee have tags as well, but I'm not 100% sure on their seasons. So make sure you go over to the YouTube channel for that. On this week's episode, we got a good one for you guys. We've got Luke Oswald and Clay Bowers from the Publicly Challenged podcast. You guys might recognize Luke's name. We've had him on the podcast before, but Clay is new. He's actually Luke's co-host now on the Publicly Challenged show. He's been there since October. He's got a pretty cool background in foraging and hunting. We talked about all of that stuff. Of course, we talked about their seasons from this last fall. We got into all the foraging stuff, not all of it, but we covered a lot of ground on that. We talked about whether or not they've seen an uptick in pressure on public land since it seems to become more popular all the time. We talked about a lot of different stuff on this episode. I think you guys are going to enjoy it. I know I did. It's always fun talking to Luke, and then Clay, I mean, he just fit right in. So it was a good time. I think you guys will like the episode. So let's get into it, number 121. This is the Ridge Hunter Outdoors Podcast. All right, we've had Luke on in the past. He's from Publicly Challenged Podcast. If you guys don't listen to that, make sure you go check it out. But we've got his co-host, Clay, on with us this time. So this is going to be a good conversation. We were just talking before that there's five of us, so hopefully it doesn't get too crammed trying to talk at the same time. But I think it's going to be good. We're going to get into some foraging stuff. We might get into a little bit of podcasting stuff, just so you guys can kind of maybe hear a little bit about that, because I think it could be interesting discussion on just kind of how things work. I'm always interested in how things work for other things that go on, industries and whatnot. But before we do, Luke, how's it going, man? It's been a little while since we've talked.
Yeah. I think we've probably seen each other. Well, I don't know. We either saw each other last summer or we talked before then or after. I can't recall. But
at the very least, the Deer and Beer Fest, right?
Yeah, somewhere around there, probably August.
For sure.
Something like that.
And then this is the first time we've got to meet Clay. So, actually, before we get into anything, Clay, why don't you just give us a little rundown? I know Luke was on with us before, so he knows that usually when we have first-time guests, we go, like, way down memory lane, how'd you get started in the outdoors and all that. But give us a little synopsis on Clay. How'd you get to where you're at now working with Luke?
Well, I first was a guest on Luke's podcast, and then we kind of became friends. And then he calls me all the time.
Clay, I'm going to stop you right there. if anybody has ever seen the movie Step Brothers, it was like that. We had that exact moment.
Did we just become best friends?
Yeah. Nah, haven't seen it.
So yeah, basically, but I ended up on Luke's podcast as a guest. I can't remember, a few years ago.
Like 2018 or 19.
So. Yeah. And I was a guest on there because I am a forager. I have been teaching foraging since about 2010, 11, somewhere in there. And I've been foraging though for nearly two decades. And I've actually just had a lifelong interest with plants. And when I was a little kid, I used to, you know, I tell this story a lot, but stinging nettle, I used to run around and sting myself with it when I was like a 5-year-old. And then I would just run around and grab other plants to see if they would counteract the sting.
That's interesting, to say the least.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're a curious mind. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. But then basically, if you want to hear the whole full breakdown, you know, you could listen to Luke's podcast, or I've also been on a couple other podcasts where I've told the whole breakdown of the story of like what got me into foraging.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. And if you want to send me that or just tell me what episode it is, when we get done, I'll link it in the description so everybody can find it too.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I do want to say real quick, while foraging is like what I do for like teaching and most people know me, I'm also really big into hunting. I like hunting a lot. So.
Okay. What? So yeah. I guess foraging came first and then hunting, or?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Was that
trapping, Clay?
And trapping. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. Was that, did you get into hunting kind of because you were into foraging and it was like, it led into that, or was it like you thought you were in the outdoors anyway, you might as well hunt something while you're out there in the fall?
Well, I guess it just came from wanting to be more food secure
general. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's like probably the leading cause of it. And then I just started to really love it. You know, it's like at first it was like this thing, like, okay, I just want to be able to hunt. And then trapping, in particular, because like, I've said this before a million times on other podcasts, I would like, if I could legally trap everything, I would do that over hunting any day.
Yeah.
Like I would trap deer if it was allowed.
That would be interesting as well. That would be interesting. You're saying it was more of a balanced diet thing. You needed some protein to go with the stuff you were foraging for.
But also because I just, at one point in time, I was more of like into it because of survivalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now it's not. Now it's actually swinging back in that direction, I enjoyed like a 10-year period there where I wasn't into it all because of survivalism.
Right. I feel like, after 2020, there's probably a lot of people in it for that reason.
Yeah.
And we actually got a lot of new people, I think, in hunting for partly that reason. I mean, when you can't go to the grocery store and you got to take out a loan to buy meat or anything with protein in it, I mean, it makes sense to go hunting, right?
Yeah.
And then the foraging is kind of the same way. I got to assume that's a lot to do with it as well. And just kind of your curiosity you were talking about, and then finding different things that you can consume or not and do that. So actually, and on that note, I think we talked to Luke about it, either on the podcast we talked to him. Is there any trial and error for you when you're foraging and finding new stuff? Have you ever had a bad experience on something new that you've tried?
No, I've never eaten something that was kind of like toxic.
Okay.
But I have definitely like freaked myself out that I have,
right.
which I think that almost every forager has done, including, you know, like you talk to some of the big foragers around the country and almost everybody has like had some sort of panic attack about the carrot family. So the carrot family is one of the most widespread plant families in the world, but also contains some of the most poisonous plants in the world.
Okay.
And so you know, you could be out there totally fine picking a wild parsnip, for instance, and convince yourself like, oh my god, maybe I accidentally picked poison hemlock in this batch of parsnips, but you know, you never do really, but it's just something that you're want to have an abundance of caution around.
Yeah. I mean, at the very least, you probably don't do it more than once, right?
Yep.
Some of that stuff is a one-time deal, I'm guessing.
Kind of like mulberries.
Yeah.
To this day, I can't stand the smell of mulberries.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I got sick on mulberries when I was a kid, and that was awful. And I can't even stand the smell of them anymore.
Yeah, mulberries, actually, funny you bring that up. Mulberries was the very first wild food that I ever ate. And I also got really sick of them. I only started liking them again last year.
Really?
Yeah. I can believe that. I can. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So, Luke, let's go to you first on the season. How'd your hunting season go this year?
Oh, man. I tried a lot of new spots.
Yeah.
I actually, some of my old faithful ones that I liked, I went there a couple times and just said, you know what? I need to explore more. I need to find new spots and different things. And there were some old ones that I hadn't visited, but always had in the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. So I started visiting those. Even though I didn't kill a giant, I actually saw, and I couldn't find a place to set up, and a booner on public land. And it was 62.8 yards. And I remember that distinctly because it's etched in my mind forever.
Yep.
As I sat there and clicked my rangefinder about 40 times on him, going, oh man, I don't know. And just hesitated. And even though I did the right thing, even the other day I was driving thinking about it and going, man, I wonder if I could have taken that shot. Yep. I wonder if I would have made it. And honestly, I mean, if I would have tested my broadheads and shot that far with them and been confident, it would have been a different story. But it was some different broadheads I was using this year, and I hadn't shot them past 40 yards, so I had no idea how they were going to fly.
Right, right. That's the smart decision, but that probably doesn't go away. It hasn't for me. I've had some like that where maybe I should have shot, and then you always think about it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he was the biggest deer I've seen on public land, but he was definitely up there in the top 10.
Wow.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I sat on the ground. I kicked my way through some multiflora rose and a little bit of honeysuckle, and found a nice little nested spot in a corner where I thought something was going to come out. And sure enough, it came out right in front of me and hooked. Well, he came out in front of me at like 70 yards or something, and he got up to 62. And then he was fully broadside. And I mean, that sun was just starting to set, and I mean, it was a perfect scene.
Right.
If I had a camera, it would have been a great shot too.
Right.
But it's etched in my mind, and that's my one regret. But I took a couple does and, filled the freezer, and I can't complain.
For sure. Yep. Anytime you can, I mean, anybody that hunts public ground or even permission ground that maybe borders public ground or permission ground in general, possibly, if you're not the only one with permission on it. Anytime you can kill any deer in that scenario is a win.
Yeah.
I mean,
Clay had a pretty good season too.
Yeah.
He was doing a little spot and stalk.
Okay. Well, that's sounds like there might be a story there.
Do tell.
It's not really like that big of a story. I can't really stand just sitting there hunting. And I've kind of made it my mission to learn how to stalk deer. And I have now twice snuck up on does in the last couple of years and shot them at pretty close ranges. But this year I snuck up on 8 does and stood there for probably 20 minutes, and then 10 of those minutes had them walk close to me and stare at me and stomp their feet and everything. And then they were at one point, the lead doe that I ended up shooting, she was probably only 15 feet from me, looking straight at me, but I had the luxury of the wind blowing at my face.
Yep. That's what it's all about.
And I stood there completely still. And as soon as I had a chance, I knelt down, and I always use a this was the rifle. I always use a shooting stick. I put the shooting stick down, and I shot her, and it was pretty awesome, and it felt so rewarding to like have had that experience, and it wasn't just like I was like sitting over a pile of carrots or apples or something.
Right.
That's a lot of eyes looking at you, man.
Yeah. Well, you nailed it too, though. If you got the wind and you're not just making a ton of noise going in, you can stalk a whitetail deer. And then like what you're talking about, they're standing there looking at you for 10 minutes. It's like, they know you're something different. But if a lot of times it seems like it takes two of like the three things. If they hear you and see you, if they see you and smell you, if they smell you and hear you. But like if it's just one, except for smell, if they smell you, they're pretty much gone. But if they just hear you or just see you, a lot of times they'll hang around for a long time.
Yeah.
And you can get away with shooting them at 15 feet with a rifle.
Yeah. Well, it didn't end up being 15 feet, okay. But she ended up going, walking away. But, I wasn't going to move when she was that close to me.
Right, right. When you're rifle.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Rifle hunting, you're supposed to be able to shoot them from farther away.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to sneak that close.
Yeah, but I what ended up actually happening was it's this public land 4 miles from my house, mm-hmm. and there's a big long trail that I think at one point in time may have been like a gas line.
Okay, yeah.
Or something. So there's not a lot of plants that are growing on it because like I think maybe it had been kept clear of plant life for so long that it kind of doesn't grow. Mm-hmm. And I was walking down it, and then it opens up into this big field. Well, what ended up happening was I walked that super slow, and then I got right to that opening of the field, and I was just like, ah, crap. I kind of walked right out into the opening, and I'm like, oh, no, there's mm-hmm. deer right there.
Yeah, as there always is. If you're going to get that close to them, you ought to try – I heard of a guy using a spear on some hogs one time. You should maybe try something like that. Maybe try something like that.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting. You and Tim Wells, you could have the spear videos. Put a GoPro on that thing.
Yeah.
So, funny story about that, about the spear. Before that happened, Clay was with me on that trip.
Uh-huh.
And I shot a hog that was running full bore, and I hit a little forward in the shoulder. Mm-hmm. I mean, it still went into that animal and went out the other side and broke off. Mm-hmm. And it ran past Clay's, I think your son was at mm-hmm. first.
Yeah.
His son put one in its guts mm-hmm. on the run. Clay proceeds to shoot one with his French warbow into that. So now that boar has two crossbow bolts and a heavy, heavy arrow in it.
Uh-huh.
And it's still there. It's kind of laid up. I come walking up like, I don't know, 15 minutes later after all this goes down, because mm-hmm. I'm following the blood trail, and it went one direction and then back and back towards Clay. And I'm like, oh, geez, this thing doubled back, went towards Clay. I come up on Clay, and Clay's got a knife in his hand, and I think it's like a pocket knife or something. Like, it's not very large.
No. Not exactly a Bowie knife.
And a big old branch. And he's coming up on this thing, and he's going to club it and try and knife it to finish it off because there's so many arrows in this thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. He's just going to go up there and beat it with a stick. I mean, hey, you got to do what you got to do, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
I might have tore him up.
It would not be the first time that I had to club an animal that wasn't, I have actually done that to deer, like roadkill deer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just make sure you're...
It is the humane thing to do if you see a deer that's had like its back legs broken, yeah. For instance, on the.
I get it. But just,
just make sure your club's maybe, not rotten whenever you beat the hell out of it. That sounds humane to me.
I was thinking lead with the roadkill thing.
Yeah.
I just, I go around clubbing deer occasionally. That's awesome. That's great. No, that's so. How long have you been hunting, Clay?
I'm 41. I've been hunting. Like I started getting into like squirrel hunting mm-hmm. in like at around probably 24 or 25.
Okay.
And then that was like a couple year period where I just only shot squirrels mm-hmm. and that was it. And then And I even did that with like a blowgun, you know.
Oh, okay.
Like sometimes. And then it morphed into that plus rabbits. And then I would go out deer hunting and never be successful.
Mm-hmm. As many of us do.
Couldn't find a big enough club or what?
Yeah, exactly. I think just basically the problem was I kept getting invited by my stepdad to this 40-acre plot. And, you know, I didn't know anything about wind. I didn't know anything about just anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I would go out there and just sit in the blind. Mm-hmm. And spend days on end and never see a single deer.
Right.
Not even a doe, you know?
Yeah. That actually seems to be a pretty natural progression. Cause like I said, we generally ask all the new guests to like where they started and everything. And a lot of times it's small game, with the exception of one guy who I think the first thing he ever killed was a bear with his bow. But most of them start small game and then work their way up into deer hunting eventually. And then usually at the start, it's not real pretty, not very successful, but that's part of learning and getting better at it, right?
Like, always a learning curve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think those experiences also help make it worth more when you do finally get to sneak on up on one 15 feet away and eventually kill it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
If you guys are looking for your own piece of ground to manage and hunt, Rodney Hawkins is a guy you need to talk to. He grew up hunting and fishing in Southern Illinois, and he's now putting that love for the outdoors into selling recreational properties as a land specialist with Midwest Farm and Land. Midwest Farm and Land isn't your average real estate company. They do residential properties, but they also do a ton of recreational property sales as well. Rodney himself sold over $7 million worth of properties last year alone. They've got agents like him all over Illinois, so they're really a local company with a national reach. For more info on them, what might be available, or even getting your property listed if you're looking to get rid of one and maybe get into something else, you can contact Rodney directly at 618-925-3153, and he'll get you taken care of. He's also got his own company called RG Outdoors that currently has products from Radix Hunting, Tacticam Trail Cameras, Camo Dust, and he's adding new stuff all the time. So if you're interested in any of that, go over to their Facebook page, RG Outdoors. Email them at rgoutdoors@yahoo.com. Or again, just call Rodney directly at 618-925-3153.
I really still do to this day, though, enjoy small game hunting.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of fun, especially I know Jeff used to do quite a bit of it, running dogs even for rabbits and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is even a whole nother experience.
Yeah.
But, Luke, you can probably attest to that, too. It does seem like a lot of guys do start small and then get into bigger. Even at, like, Clay's talking, even being 24, 25, even though a lot of people are starting at maybe 6 or 7 or whatever doing it. But that seems to be a pretty natural progression.
Yeah, I agree with that. Little known fact, though, Clay actually eats more squirrel meat than venison every year.
That's a lot of squirrels. You could kill one deer, and you got to kill a lot of squirrels to make that happen.
Oh, yeah.
I don't shoot that many squirrels.
Okay.
I have a question for you guys. Where are you at right now?
We are in Southern Illinois. You mean like that location wise?
Yeah. Okay. So Southern Illinois. Do you guys ever hunt with feists? Have you ever hunted with them?
Mm-mm.
I had some. I had some Chihuahua mixes that I squirrel hunted with around the house for a while.
Oh, okay. I see. Well, I have a mountain feist, and he's about 8 months old. But our mm-hmm. squirrel season just ended last weekend,
mm-hmm.
and he just started treeing squirrels. So.
Yeah, really,
that's a lot of fun.
It's a blast. I mean, we went and took a weekend to go, me and my son, to go squirrel hunting last weekend, and it was unsuccessful. But it was really fun to watch him because he treed so many squirrels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. You're little mixes were getting pretty good at treeing them there for a while.
Yeah, that one would climb the tree. I had pictures of him up in a pine tree trying to get to his squirrel.
Wow.
Little Chihuahua mix, and he was jumping. Well, you know them white pines, they got branches 2 to 3 feet apart, you know, up the tree. And he worked his way up about probably 20 feet.
Yeah.
And
way too high for him.
Way too high for him. I don't know how you got up there, but you're going to find your own way down.
yeah, no doubt.
But yeah, they was treeing squirrels and was actually doing pretty good. And then, you know, this, that, and the other happened, and mm-hmm. they're not with us anymore. But
yeah,
and I never got back into it. But
yeah,
it was a lot of fun.
So I got a question going back to the deer season this year. Have you guys, and maybe over the past few years, have you guys noticed on public land a lot of extra pressure, like in the last few years? Because it does seem to be becoming more and more popular, like the public land thing, for, I mean, partially, I think the hunting public would have a lot to do with it, their influence on people, like maybe even just realizing that there is public ground to hunt, you know, like I don't think a lot of people even before knew. Obviously, we have a few more hunters now, like we said, after 2020. But have you guys noticed, like, any uptick in pressure? And then how was this last season as far as that goes, where you guys are hunting public ground?
Well, I noticed there's an increase since, you know, I first started, but there's always a pressure during the rut. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you get, like, the first 2 or 3 weeks in November, well, I should say first 2 weeks before shotgun season starts, right? Mm-hmm. That's when the mad rush is. Everybody's taking vacation. You know, guys are hitting public hard. Mm-hmm. I actually was going to recover my deer. I left. I came back. Good story about that. Pheasant hunters actually found my deer. I left and said, I can't find it. I'm going to come back. I don't want to screw up because I had to share the hunting ground with the pheasant hunters. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't want to go kicking up a bunch of birds walking through here. I'll let you guys do your thing and I'll come back in like 2-3 hours and I'm going to put my orange vest on and I'll come looking for them. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you know, here, give me your number. If our dog or we find it, we'll give you a call. It wasn't no sooner than I got home. The guy gives me a phone call and says, hey, we found your deer. We dragged it out onto the path for you. It was in some of the tall brush. He said, that's awesome. It's right on the path. He dropped a pin for me. I went and grabbed it and drug it back. Another hunter was on his way out and helped me, you know, just a good community of folks for the most part.
Yeah, cool.
But I had one guy as I'm standing there getting ready to go get my deer. And he goes, or the day before when I shot it that night, he goes, hey, I just want to ask you, I'm going to set up a ground blind real quick and do a bunch of rattling for about 15 minutes. And he said, and then I'm going to move about 300 yards down that way. And I showed him on X, I said, where I'm going to be. I said, just don't come in this area. Well, I'm going to go there next. And I'm like, I just said, I'm going to be in there. Right. What part of that don't you get?
Right.
And sure enough, I heard him. He didn't go where I was. He finally got the hint.
Yeah.
But he was out there and I could hear him beating on that horn so loud. And then he left, got in his car, and you could hear him pulling out like a maniac, going mm-hmm. down the road as fast as he could. And that's all he was doing is just hopping and rattling.
Yeah.
I can't imagine how many other hunts he screwed up. Right. No care about wind direction, anything. And but that's the kind of stuff you have to encounter. But at the same time, if you're not a fair weather hunter mm-hmm. and you don't mind missing a football game on a Sunday afternoon or something like that, you've got mostly public land is all to yourself, except for that little window of the rut. So if you want to hunt the rut, you're going to know it's going to be crowded. You're going to deal with some crazies. And, you know, that's kind of what it's going to be. But other than that, I still find that I'm the only one out there in a lot of places.
Really?
Especially if you like take a day off during the week and it's like October.
Oh, yeah.
You're not going to see anybody else.
Yeah, for sure. You've seen that there even on the permission ground you're hunting next to public, I think.
Yeah.
The pressure really starts to tick up there. First week of November?
Yeah, about the first week of November, you start seeing people around there that you hadn't seen before. And, you know, you'll see vehicles parked around in the parking spots. And sometimes you'll see people walking on the permission property because they can't tell the purple paint line, you know.
Yeah.
So, but
you'll have it on your big
probably time. That guy with the ground blind and the rattling horns.
Yeah. I think it probably was him. I heard a car come speeding down the road. You know, so.
Yeah.
But, I mean, about the first week of November, but then after shotgun season's over with, like you said, you pretty well got it all to yourself then after that.
Yeah. You don't see too many people late season.
No.
And I didn't get out much late season, but even if there was, you know, normally on a year, if I'm hunting late season, you hardly see a soul out there unless you get like, it's warm late season and you mm-hmm. get that cold front. Mm-hmm. That for some reason, people still want to come in because they think the deer are going to be moving like crazy. But mm-hmm.
that's something that, you know, you hear guys talk about a lot and on other podcasts and stuff is like, some people think it's bad that you guys or guys like you that are putting out public land content, right. Are like ruining it for everybody else. Cause you're promoting public land hunting and like burning spots out and there's so many people moving into public, but like I didn't know if that was actually something you guys seen in your experience, and maybe there is some localized stuff, like maybe in Iowa or something, where that is the case. But, like, in our experience, not hunting a ton of public ground, but every now and then, and just like I said, Jeff hunting next to it, doesn't seem like there's just a crazy amount of people piling in just because there's people putting out good content that comes from public ground.
Yeah, for the most part, I don't think it is. The only time I ever see that is if, like, somebody actually calls something out.
Yeah.
You'll get a huge group of people there that'll all bump into each other and go, oh, this sucks, it's too crowded, and they leave.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of the end of it, really. I mean, I don't see them. You know, a lot of people bash those people, but they've done probably more good for public land and conservation and everything than they ever have to, you know, tarnish the name of public land.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people, it's not like you're going to do too much in Iowa anyway, that you have to wait 2-3 years yeah. to draw a tag anyway. I mean, they've got it to where it's pretty well limited on how much, you know, how much use of the public land happens anyway. So yeah. I wouldn't worry about it. I notice a lot of times in the big cities, people will come down from the big cities and any of that land is flocked to that's close to it, whatever is the closest public land to that. But I mean, if they're willing to travel, why not travel yourself a little bit, you know,
yeah,
instead of going 10 minutes or 20 minutes north of you, maybe go, you know, an hour south.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes.
For sure. And that makes sense numbers wise. The closer you get to more people on your public spots, there's probably going to be more people hunting there. Like you said, if you're willing to travel just a little bit in an hour, like that's pretty doable. You know, you get up a little bit earlier and get out there, and then gives you enough time to wake up a little bit maybe and drink your coffee or whatever. And then by the time you get there, you're fine. But
yeah,
it's just, you hear a lot of people talk about that, and I didn't know what your guys' experience was. So I figured you would be the people to ask.
I personally think that I just want to say that where I see the most people and the most crowding is during duck season and the beginning.
The places that have the overlap with the duck spots and the deer spots, you mean?
Yeah. Those definitely. And actually sometimes pulling up to a spot to go duck hunting on like one of the first couple weekends and not being able to find a place because they're so overloaded
mm-hmm.
with other duck hunters.
Right. I got to figure that's because, like with deer hunting, a lot of people have either permission ground or private ground where they have to go deer hunt and they have access to somewhere. But like for duck hunting, I'd have to assume a huge percentage of duck hunting is done on public ground because not everybody has, you know, like a place to go hunt ducks, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the public duck hunting that we do is on public stuff, but it's not like it's separated. It's draw units or whatever. And then I am on a lease with a guy too, but I would assume that has a lot to do with it, like just the lack of access to other duck hunting spots. But that's something I didn't really think about because there are a lot of places, obviously, I guess, where you're hunting that they both have waterfowl hunters and deer hunters at the same time. And that's getting into like, when waterfowl season starts down here, you're normally right around Thanksgiving. So you're talking like prime time to be deer hunting too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One time many years ago, me and a buddy rolled up to go duck hunting and pull up on this guy who's up in his tree stand on the edge of the lake. And he was pissed at us, you know, he's like, what are you doing here? And we're like, we're duck hunting.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, like we're going right there.
Uh-huh. He should have brought decoys and a shotgun. He could have just done both.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I first started public land, I didn't know that there was duck hunting in one of the areas that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
And I set up and what I thought was a game trail because it was so narrow. I was like, oh man, this is just a really heavy game trail and it opens up.
Uh-huh.
Well, it turns out it opens up to like a marsh where there's actually a duck blind and it's got a number on it.
Uh-huh.
And the trail that's super narrow that was heavily worn was actually just duck hunting.
Yeah, trail.
And the guy on the foot trail comes up and he's like, I go wave to him and he's like, and I go, same thing, you know, like,
yeah.
No big deal. You know, it is what it is. I screwed up and you know, whatever. But looking back now, if I would have known better, I would actually set up to where that guy would walk through that timber, push mm-hmm. the deer across the marsh right to me.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of stuff that I look for now. Even during the rut, when all those other morons were out there running, jumping out of the truck, rattling their horns as fast and loud as they can for 15 minutes straight, and then moving to the next spot. Same thing. I found a little a little cutout and I actually shot a doe. And just because I was like, you know, expectations versus reality are going to come into play here, mm-hmm. to where just because I saw that giant deer before, it doesn't mean I'm going to see him again.
Yeah.
He may have been pushed completely out of here and went on to a tiny little piece of private connecting to it.
Yeah.
Then I'm never going to get to him. Mm-hmm. But if I play my cards right, at least I can let these people push deer to me. And that's exactly what I did. And they pushed him into a little cove that I found.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I dropped a doe that night.
Yeah. That's something that Austin Stone from Tactical Approach, we've had him on a few times. He's a friend of mine. And he talks about it's not necessarily always just getting the farthest away, but it's the overlooked spots like that people miss, those little nooks like you're talking about, or little places where people coming in are going to push deer, like where the deer feel safe going. They don't necessarily have to be a long ways away from everybody, but if they're on public ground a lot, they probably know they're going to have some human interaction. They're just looking for that place where they can stay out of sight, you know, or just like where they feel safe. It doesn't necessarily have to be 2 miles off the road.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was looking at too. And it was, I mean, I was only 200 yards from one parking lot, but there was honeysuckle so thick,
mm-hmm.
you couldn't even get through it between that parking lot and where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I followed a creek bank to get there. And then once I got there, I found it on the map and I was like, holy cow, this thing opens wide up. They can come in, they can drink, they can browse all the way here.
Yeah.
There's cover and there's edges. I was like, this is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, it came right into that opening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow.
That's the one that the pheasant hunters ended up finding?
Yes, it is. Yes, hey, it is.
That's cool too, because I feel like and you could speak to this more than I can, but for all the bad interactions you have, it seems like you have two or three good ones. The bad ones usually stand out more to a lot of people. And like, if you're doing a podcast or doing a show, it gets the clicks, right? Like the bad interaction. But there are so many people that are, it does seem like, that are willing to help, you know, that you run into on public ground. And there's a lot of like-minded people, seems like.
Absolutely. In fact, I've had way more positive encounters than negative. I think mm-hmm. I've only had one where somebody like followed me out of the timber and kept real close, but never said anything instead of like, hey, how was it going or anything like that, trying to intimidate me. Right.
Right.
But other than that, I've never had a bad experience ever. And in fact, I got really gutsy one time and wanted to use some river access mm-hmm. and the water was high and moving. And so the spot I wanted to go to was downstream, so it was super easy to get there.
Right.
And I borrowed a buddy's kayak and I took my kayak. So I had two kayaks, one with my gear in it and a decoy and everything, and the other one was just me in it and going. And the water, this is, mind you, this is November, this is like second week of November,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of chilly, pretty chilly out, but like a little bit warm, but the water was just moving. And I get there and get to my spot. And first thing, I come climbing up that creek bank with a bow in my hand. I got two does running past.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, I knew this place was good. It was just a nice little pinch point where everything had to travel through. And so I'm there and I'm like, okay. I get up on the bank and all of a sudden I'm standing there and here comes a spike buck and he's stomping at me. And he's like putting his head down like he's wanting to spar with me. And mm-hmm. I'm like, no way. This is just like crazy rut. There's deer all over in here. I look over to my left and I see a huge set of antlers move from behind a tree, and I'm like, oh man, this is heaven. So I get kind of in there and I stalk around a little bit. I get a decoy and I'm holding it up and I'm like, I don't know if he could even see that though. So I just lay it down and get up into the tree, get set up, and just start kind of real softly grunting just to see if he'll come in. He doesn't mm-hmm. move. That deer was smart enough. I mean, I got in a little late because everything and the whole process of getting there,
right.
But I, you know, I was there long enough and watched him, and finally he got up last light and he went the opposite direction. I was like, dang it.
Right.
I should have set up, you know, the other side of him or whatever. Didn't know, but I got in there. I had to get out of there. So I pack up all my stuff and start paddling upstream. I get out of the little inlet I'm in and onto the main river. And I am paddling with all of my might.
Mm-hmm.
And no joke, it was a half hour of solid paddling.
My arms felt like they were
gonna fall off. My rotator cuffs were on fire. And I'm like, this is bad. Like, I might die. There's a dam not too far from here. Uh-huh. And I could get pushed all the way down there if I say heck with it and stop paddling. And it wasn't even enough to where I was in the middle of the river at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really try and paddle either way. I'm like, well, maybe I could go downstream and paddle over.
Right.
And get to the bank like at a diagonal. And then just walk it back. But it was all private land on the other side of the river. And I'm
right.
Like, to where my truck is. And I'm like, dang it, I don't know what I'm going to do. Finally, I hear a boat motor coming down the river. And I've got like a little tiny little light on the back that's like a clamp on my kayak, you know, and I clamped it on all janky. And I got a headlamp and I'm just flicking it on and off at the guy.
Yeah.
And he comes pulling up and I hear the motor cut down and I'm like, hey, man, I don't know if you can help me, like give me a tow or something. And he's like, just pull your kayak over here. And he goes, one thing, you got a deer in there first? He wanted to know. He's like,
right.
And I said, no, I did get one. He goes, oh, good. He goes, man, you must have balls the size, size of basketball.
That's what that other kayak's for.
he goes, I would have never done something like this. And he goes, hang on one second. And he gets his phone out and takes a picture. And he goes, I got to show my buddies this. And he goes, but yeah, I'll give you a ride. So he actually took my kayak, pulled it up on the boat, and I got in the boat. And he took me all the way to the boat launch.
That's awesome.
And I loaded up and I was like, thank you so much, man. You know, like I'll pay you whatever. And he goes, no, man. He goes, we're hunters. We help each other out whenever we can. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that is awesome. Shook his hand and just, you know, we went our separate ways. But yeah. What an interaction, right?
Yeah, that's
so
awesome.
So you never, that never crossed your mind how to get back before you started?
It did, but I thought I could make it. Oh, okay. I really did. I thought I could make it. Right.
So it was partially the big worst... balls then, right?
Partially, I thought I could do it. The thing that really had me was dragging the other kayak. But why there's no way I was going to cut loose all my gear, right?
Right,
like, right.
My
right.
stand and my sticks and my bow, you know?
Like, one go, we all go, right?
yeah. Like any good captain, you're going down with the rest of the ship.
Yeah.
That's right.
No doubt.
That's right.
If you're going to go out, you're going out a man, you know?
That's right.
You can tell your buddies you drowned.
It was worth it, though. It was worth getting there.
Yeah, for sure. Your buddies can tell the story about you drowning on the kayak, but you don't really want to go back and tell them that you were a wuss and had to cut ties with all your gear and everything. Nobody wants to be that guy. Yeah. Well, let's get into a little bit of podcast stuff, because obviously you guys are doing the show now. Clay, how long have you been co-hosting with him?
Since, like, October, right?
Okay.
I think, right around there. Deer season.
Cool. Are you guys doing it this setup most of the time, like when you're co-hosting and then you bring on a guest through a Zoom?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, we do video conference.
Okay, cool. How's everything going? I mean, like obviously it's going okay.
Yeah. I think that it's going excellently. Not really sure what happened to Luke there.
Oh, did we lose him?
I don't know, but I'm happy to keep talking.
Hey, actually, let's take a time out for a second because I'm going to go grab a charger for my phone so it doesn't die, and then we'll just pick up right here. You want to?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, I'll be right back. If you guys plant food plots and you don't know who Grandpa Ray Outdoors is, you need to look them up. They specialize in providing the best nutrition for white-tailed deer on your property, starting with the soil. They've got a full line of high-quality food plot seed and plant foods. With over 14 different food plot blends to choose from, you won't have any trouble finding what you're looking for. They've got fall and spring blends, corn and beans, switchgrass, liquid fertilizer, soil test kits, you name it. When it comes to planting, they've got it. They're not just about selling their products, though. They were started in 2015. John, the owner, has been in the business since 1991. So with that knowledge that he's acquired, he's going to be able to answer any questions you have about what blends would be best for your specific property. That way you can achieve the best results possible. Like us, John and his team don't believe in a cookie-cutter approach to wildlife nutrition. They're going to treat you and your situation individually. We've used tons of their seed on client properties, on our own properties, and the results have always been as good, if not better, than advertised. That's why we partnered with them in the first place. If you want to, go to GrandpaRayOutdoors.com, use the discount code RHOPODCAST, that's all lowercase, no space, and you get 5% off your entire order there. You guys need to go check them out if you care about getting the most bang for your buck when it comes to your food plots. Let's just pick up right there. Yeah, we were talking about, we were getting into the podcast. So you've been on since October. You guys are running kind of this setup, similar to this with doing the Zoom meetings and everything with that. So I'm actually curious, do you have like what are you recording through, Clay? And then Luke, or do you guys both have boards that you're using to record through, or are you just going to your computer with your mics, or do you have what's the word I'm looking for? I can't even think of it. Are you going from your mic through something to your computer? What's your actual setup look like?
Yeah, I personally have a USB dual pre-project series that my mic goes into and then plugs into my computer.
Okay. So that's like, that's your setup, and then you're just going straight from the computer to, and then you guys are doing the Zoom. And Luke, I guess, are you set up the same way, or do you have a board there?
No, I have a board on my end that okay. I record into. And then I take his channel, my channel, and then whoever the guest is, and we all record those into my soundboard.
Nice.
And do it on that end. I mean, Clay's is more advanced than what he's saying, though. He's actually got gain adjustment and everything else on his end, too.
Right.
And I tell him as I set my audio levels where to set his, mm-hmm. so I get the peak coming through on my end.
Right, right. What kind of board are you running?
I am running a Zoom.
Okay, yeah. We had a Zoom before this one, and then I got the Rodecaster, and I was just curious because I've heard that the Rodecaster 2 is even a lot better than the 1, and I didn't know. The guys that are running it say there's a lot of stuff you can do. But here's my thing.
Yeah.
What I liked about the Zoom, and it was simple and very portable. I do like the onboard processing that this has that cuts down a lot on editing time, but at the same time, like on the second one or even on this, it does stuff that I don't even know how to use. So there's some features that aren't even doing me any good. It's kind of like having, if I had one of those really fancy bow sights, I probably would just be wasting my money because I probably wouldn't be using it, you know, like it should be used anyway. So
yeah,
That's kind of where I'm at on it. But I really do like this one for our setup. But again, we're not doing two different locations. So I get, does that run pretty smooth most of the time?
For the most part. Yeah. I don't think there's really any hiccups. Do you think there's anything, Clay?
I don't know. And actually now, so previously I had audio issues and it was just, it was just the dumbest thing ever. It was like, I had this setup.
You set that up really well, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, I just admitted it was just dumb. We're on Zoom, and I just didn't click use this mic. So I was using the computer's microphone.
So the headset was a prop.
It wasn't until I was doing edits, and it was when Clay recorded a podcast by himself, and I was rolling through the video because I hadn't seen or wasn't there to listen to it as it was going on. So I was like, if I watch the video feed of it, it'll be easier for me to pick up on EQs or anything that, you know, need to be dropped out or kind of phased. And I'm watching Clay, and it's when it dawned on me, I saw him lean in and the audio changed, and I was like, he got closer to his mic. He's using his computer mic. Yeah. Immediately.
Wait a minute.
Just a string of texts and everything else. Because he's the one who kept complaining that his audio was terrible.
Right.
And I kept joking with him, telling him, like, no, it's just your voice. Your voice is terrible. You
know? That first text go, hey, dumbass.
Pretty close. Yeah. Pretty close to that.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. We've had plenty of gaffes and screw-ups before, too. Fortunately, knock on wood, I have yet to forget to hit the record button. Have you ever done that? Got started a conversation with anybody? Because I've heard horror stories of having guests on and forgetting to hit the record button.
No, because I actually record the video too.
Right.
So
okay.
Even if I forget one, there's one that I'm always going to have to ask them to further permission, and that's for the video, and that pops up on their screen.
Yep.
So fortunately, no, I have had one podcast where I was afraid to tell the guy. It was when I first started. Mm-hmm. And I was afraid to tell the guy that I screwed up the audio. I lost the audio file on my hard drive, couldn't recover it, and it was lost. And he kept texting me like 6 months later. He's like, hey, whatever happened to the audio? You know, when's our podcast coming up?
Right.
You know, it's over and over. And he was a guest at the time. I was a pretty big guest, and I didn't know how to break it to him. And finally, mm-hmm. I just came out clean and said, hey, do you think maybe we could record another one? The audio got screwed up and I never did. And he's like, why didn't you tell me that? Like, you know, 4 months ago.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
We did have one actually when we were using the Zoom that it was, I think it was the four of us. It was us three and then Nate. Mm-hmm. And we were in the other room and we recorded 45 minutes of it was a pretty good episode for us, you know, decent content. And we either had to stop for something, or maybe we, I don't think we were done. I think we had to stop for a break, much like we do occasionally. And we come back, and it was just gone. All 45 minutes
it was just gone
off the card. And then we, I don't even know if
you can't. It's something you, if one of them is kind of easy flow, but you just no way you could recreate the conversations, you mm-hmm. know. It's just, it's gone to this day.
Yep. I still don't remember what we talked about really, but it would have been a decent episode. And then it was probably less than stellar after we did everything the second time, you know.
Canyon, have you ever worked on a TV show ever?
I have not. I have seen a little bit, like, in school. I actually went to do a couple internships and, like, interviewed for them or whatever, and I've seen a little bit of, like, the stuff that goes on in that. But I've never actually worked on anything like that.
Okay, because I have actually filmed on a couple TV shows, and mm-hmm. They'll have you do, like, what you guys just said. You'll do this whole thing, mm-hmm. and then they'll be like, okay, that was natural. Now do that again, and you're like, "Oh,
right, yeah. right." Well, what do you mean, do it again? Did you guys not hit the red button?
We're gonna have to start over with them six beers because we can't do that.
That's something that we did the show this fall though, like the YouTube show hunting and stuff. Mm-hmm. And me and Blake go back and forth all the time because like. We'll be doing our interview or whatever, and we'll screw it up, and we'll just get one of these marker, take two, and then we'll start over. And Blake will record, and then he'll give me the video back, and I'll have to go through, like, 4 minutes of him trying to get an interview where he's done three different cuts because he started over because he thought he screwed something up, and then I have to figure out which one is good. And there's been times where I'll pull, like, a little bit from the first one and a little bit from the second one and just kind of mash them together because, you know, sometimes – like, part of the first one was great, and then he forgets it in the second one. And I do the same thing. Like, you say something good in the first one, but then you screw up the end of it, and then you start the second one, and the beginning's not as good, but you end it well, and, like, it's just, it's like we were talking about. It's hard to recreate, you know, when you do something well and go back and do it again.
Yeah.
Which is why I don't envy the guys that do live shows. Mm-hmm. Have you guys ever done any of the live stuff? Luke, have you ever done any live shows or anything?
I haven't done any personally. I was on one, the OKS Hunter.
Yeah.
And that seemed to go pretty good. They don't really care about conversation or right. You know what I mean? Like, it's the OKS Hunter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the name says it all. You can get away with whatever. No, no doubt. I mean, but it all seemed to flow pretty smooth. I'm sure at times it might be hard to try and, especially if you have a guest to where you really have to work.
Oh yeah.
To get anything out of them. And I know we've all had that.
Yep.
To where it's one word answers and you're like, oh, you think you can maybe elaborate on it?
Right. Yep. Yes.
Yep. we've all had that, but for the most part, theirs seems to flow pretty good to where they, you know, I'm sure they do some edits and stuff before they drop it, but on the live itself, the live is the live.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We're changing it.
Me and Nate and Winton did one that was live, and they do it Facebook Live every week, and it seemed to, I mean, it went fine, and I think theirs seems to go okay, but I just know my luck. Something would go incredibly wrong, and then there's no fixing it, but, I mean, I guess you just got to be okay with it, you know? You said, man, I had another, the guest thing. You're talking about when you have some guests that don't always want to talk. What? I kind of have my own thoughts on how I go about it. If you have a guy on that maybe it's his first time really doing it's not a formal interview, but like being on a show, or maybe they're just someone that it takes a while for them to warm up. Like they agree to come on the podcast, but maybe a little bit begrudgingly or whatever. And like, you got to get them warmed up. If you do have those guests, and this could be for both of you, since Clay, you've been doing it a while now. How do you guys attack that? Like, how do you go at that guest to try to get them to open up a little more and elaborate?
I mean, I personally rely on my own verbal diarrhea to get through those. So right. I'll talk everybody's ear off if they give me the chance, you know.
Right.
So, you know, like we just had a couple weeks ago. I just recorded an episode on my own and had a guest that was a little bit like that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just keep trying. Yeah. You know, just keep. You know, like getting them like to try and open up. I don't know. There's whole episodes on YouTube you can watch about that.
Oh yeah.
Getting people more engaged with you and willing to open up. Mm-hmm. And I watch those sometimes and try to figure it out. But I don't know what Luke does.
If I've done enough research on the person, I try and talk to them in a way that builds them up to where they gain enough confidence to start freely talking about themselves. But I'll keep interjecting and throwing things in that are kind of accolades or something they've done to where they start to realize, oh yeah, you know, I did do that. I forgot about that. Yeah. And it kind of makes it to where they can talk more.
A little more reassuring.
I find that helps. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's just a confidence thing, you know, they're lacking it until.
For sure.
And you know, maybe they're just that humble. I don't know. I don't really have that problem. I can blab all day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I guess that's why we host podcasts probably.
I was waiting for somebody to say alcohol. That's what I
Yeah. That can help with certain guests.
Yeah. Another thing that's really good though is people in general, like you can if you ever read the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's like a psychology book.
Yeah, I've heard of it. I've never read it, but I have heard of it.
So it's a psychology book about people and like just breaking down like how people interact with one another.
Yeah.
And one thing is if you get people to talk about themselves, you know, if you show interest in things that they're interested in, they're more likely to open up to you.
Yes.
So, also true. Yep.
Yeah. So like, you could be completely uninterested in a topic that somebody else is interested in. You know, like I was just working today on a guy's house. He's talking to me about baseball. I don't care at all about baseball. And I just pretended I did.
Uh-huh.
And he's just like, oh, yeah. And he's
right. Right. Because he's interested in it for sure. And
yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of the way I go at it. And like Luke, I'm going to steal a page from your book and just because I try to do research on guests that do come on and maybe throw some of that stuff out too. But if I feel like if I can find, like I'll just keep going down, whether it is research I've done or stuff that I had planned to talk about, I'll keep going down the list until I find something that like you can see it, like the light turns on and they're interested in it. And then like you said, they will talk about that. And then I feel like once they get to talking about what they're interested in, it starts to flow a little bit better and then you can move on to maybe some other stuff because then I think it helps them gain confidence too. But the interest one has always been a big one for me. I feel like if I can figure out what they like to talk about, then they're going to want to talk about that and that leads into other stuff. And I think it also helps for the people listening too because it's interesting for me, even like let's say like for you, baseball. If I was that guy, which I really like baseball, but if I didn't even, if I could hear somebody talk about baseball and they were passionate about it and they had a knowledge of it, knew what they were talking about, to me, that's still interesting. You know what I mean? Mm. Like to hear somebody that's really into something and knowledgeable about it and maybe does it professionally or, you know, in that manner, like that still, I think, captures attention of people listening even. So I think that helps even with engagement with your people who are listening.
Yep.
I agree. Yep.
And then obviously once you find something like that, they're going to talk about it. And whether that's hunting or I mean, there's just plenty of things that we've had hunting guests on and like it's been something different that's got them talking and loosens them up, I guess, a little bit. And then I feel like you combine that with what you guys are talking about and then you could probably get over a lot of those hurdles, but we definitely do have them. You definitely still have people who don't really want to open up.
Yeah. There's also a book by Leal Landes and it's called How to Talk to Anyone.
Okay.
And it's a lot of the approaches from the book, the influence people win friends or whatever. Who wrote that one, by the way? I'm trying to think. I know who that is, Clay, but I can't.
Can't remember his name.
Not a Rockefeller. Was it a Rockefeller?
It could be a Rockefeller. Yeah.
Yeah, but
we'll go with it.
I think it was Rockefeller, but yeah. Anyway, there's a lot of books like that. The Leal Landes, she uses the same principles from that book and compounds on it. But it's the truth. If you get somebody to start talking about themselves, feel confident in it, that's how they open up. So,
yeah, for sure.
One of the things I was going to ask you guys is, what are you doing tomorrow? Are you going out fishing?
Are we going out fishing?
We're going out fishing.
It's the trout opener.
Oh, it is. See, that tells you where I'm at with it. We're actually we're more on the putting the boat on the river and running bank poles kind of fishing. So actually our prime time will be towards the end of the month. Usually
about 2 more weeks.
Yeah, usually middle April we can start catching some fish, but then down into May is when it starts getting really good for us. Mm-hmm. We
At end of May for us into June is when our catfishing is wonderful.
Yeah.
And then Clay has never been. Hopefully he comes down this summer and actually goes out and we're going to do some jugging.
There you go. We've done a little bit of that too.
Yeah. Yeah. A little trout lining, a little bank poling.
Mm-hmm. What do you guys use for bait mostly? And what are you catching mostly? Channel cat?
Channel cats mostly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes you get a few flatheads or something, but they're awesome. And I use cut bait.
Yeah.
You know, the way the rules state it, you got to have it from that body of river. So I actually go out on my buddy's dock and pull a couple up and hack them up. And that's, to me, it seems like the cut bait just works the best. I've tried a lot of other things and it seems like whatever's from that body of water that you hack up, that's what they want to eat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've had the best luck by far with cut bait or live bait. Like if we can get small enough bluegill or the right size bluegill or like a little, some kind of sunfish that we can get a hook through, that seems to be the best, especially for flatheads. Like the flatheads we've caught, I think have all been on live bait or maybe we caught one or two on cut bait. Now we've used shrimp and caught some channel cat actually.
Remember last year we had that channel cat on a shrimp, but a huge flathead had the channel cat.
The off season is upon us, and we all know that the path to success next season starts now. To consistently harvest mature bucks, you need to make the most of the upcoming months. And to do that, you need a solid plan. That's where we can help. If you guys want to improve your property to reach its full potential for wildlife, reach out to us about a consultation. We'll spend time getting to know your property and your goals for your deer herd and use that knowledge to develop a wildlife management plan that will help make the most out of the ground that you have. You can contact us through our website or social media to get started today. Yeah,
we actually had two fish on one pole.
Yeah, but Jeff got scared and he didn't pull them both up.
We didn't know what it was, and I started pulling, and all of a sudden I was like, "Oh my gosh, guys, it's big!" Because I seen this big old fin, you know, tail fin and that, and then all of a sudden the line just kind of come flying back at me, and I pulled up a little channel cat about like that.
I don't know if we had a net big enough for that flathead.
No, that flathead was big old flathead.
We were giving him crap though because he was pulling on things. It's a big fish, right? You know, and he was talking it up. It's a big fish. Then he pulled it up, and you could kind of see the tail fin, and like it was a big fish. But then he pulls up this little fiddler channel cat. We're like, "Oh yeah, Jeff, real big fish."
He was almost skint though. Flathead worked on him pretty hard.
Yeah,
I think it was like the 4th of July or something last year, and we had a full moon, and it was just. Do you guys ever notice anything when there's like a full moon on the water? You tend to catch more.
You got the fishing notes.
I have not. We've kept notes now for 2 years. I should have kept them a lot longer than that. And that, if it has, I haven't noted it. I'll put it that way.
A lot of what we see, and I don't want to jump ahead, so I'll keep this quick, or cut into your story. But if we can catch the river, because it's all we do is on a river. Mm-hmm. If we can catch it moving, like either coming up or going down. If it's stagnant, we don't have nearly as good a luck. But if we can catch it on the way up or on the way down, like after a decent rain, then we have the best luck.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. That's usually the biggest factor.
Usually
but
when
I had
it's stagnant.
I had an old timer that said when you're setting the trout lines, if you set them with the moon and so they can float with the water and follow the light of the moon as it goes down, if it's able to do that, he said you'll have the best luck. And anytime we've ever done that, it seems like, I mean, just you're pulling off a trout line where you actually got like 6 fish on the trout line.
I mean, to me, that makes sense because the moon has the pull and changes the tides and everything too, and it's light at night for the fish.
Illuminates the water,
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me, I guess. We'll have to try to keep a little bit better notes on that maybe.
But there's phases in my notebook, but I haven't noticed that, but I'm not sure that we'd, you know, set them.
Yeah,
necessarily that way either.
Yep.
Because we try to make the move. Our river fluctuates a lot just based on even a half inch of rain. We'll get fluctuation in the small river work. So that's what we pay more of attention to on our end of it.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to notate that and actually start paying attention to that as well. But we love catfishing. Mm-hmm. We don't do a whole lot of bank pulls because it's a lot of private land
right
on the stretch of river we run.
Right.
But we do like to, three of us get in a boat or my canoe and with a little outboard on it and mm-hmm. just throw out a bunch of jugs and float right with them.
Yeah.
And it seems like pretty much within about the first, I don't know, 20 minutes, you seem to catch the most, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Or at least maybe it's just that stretch of the river that
yeah
that we're catching them in too. We always go to about the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
What's your guys' limit on catfish?
We have I don't think we have a daily limit, do we?
Yeah, no, the state's unlimited.
We have you can only have so many lines per person, which is, wow. When you're bank pulling, you're only allowed
25,
I think.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I think that's about the same with jugs, too.
I think so.
Now, if we were fishing a pond or like a state park or something, you have limits there, but not on the river.
Yep.
Wow. This is all blowing my mind because, like, as a Michigander, we can only have three lines and that's it.
Really?
And trot lines, jugging, bank pulls, all that's illegal.
No kidding.
Really?
We can't do terrible limb lines. So, like, we can't tie a line off of a limb and do that, which makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And if you're riding reel fishing, you're only allowed two, mm-hmm. I believe. Mm. You're only allowed two lines then. But, Luke, you mentioned about the private land there on the river or where you guys are at. You'll probably find this interesting. You might already know it, but we were talking to the guys from BHA, the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and they're really pushing right now for opening up public access to waterways in Illinois because it was like 90-some% of waterways are technically private land. So like when you're floating down the river, technically you're trespassing on people, which is crazy because how do you own a piece of water that's constantly moving?
That law changed, and it wasn't that far from me. In Morris, Illinois, there was a guy that owned the farmland, and he owned both sides of it. And mm-hmm. there was a guy, because at the time, technically, unless you were wading through it, even then, you had to own both sides mm-hmm. of the water. And so this guy would take a canoe and get out and wade in waders and go up onto the bank of both sides. And what he was doing was taking fossils and arrowheads.
Okay.
And so the guy took him to court because he said, you are physically removing my property mm-hmm. and taking it and then profiting from my property that you have stolen, because apparently this guy was also into collecting fossils.
Right.
And it started out into the turn of this whole turf war. Well, it ended up changing the state's the terms of navigable waters mm-hmm. to where it used to be you could actually take a canoe down a creek, and as long as you didn't get out of that canoe, you weren't trespassing.
Right.
Well, now the way it reads is one, navigable means that it has to be large enough for a certain size vessel mm-hmm. to be able to go through. And then on the smaller waterways, if somebody owns both sides of the land, technically you're not even supposed to cross that water.
Right.
And if you get out and even set foot into that creek, you're now trespassing. And it didn't used to be that
way. Right.
Now it is.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I see both sides of that coin. And I see where that guy could get upset, especially, I mean, I don't know how much this guy was harvesting, but in order for the state to even get involved over picking up one rock, I don't think that's the case.
No, right.
This guy had to have been digging into a bank and taking buckets.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I live on a creek myself, and I've often had people in there. And, you know, for the most part, I'm pretty friendly about it until, you know, I actually had to chase some kids out of there. They were ripping through with razors, you know, like race the uh-huh. you know, souped up ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I said, if you're respectful and you're driving through here slow, I'm not going to say anything. And I told the guys that first.
Right.
But then it started being him and two of his buddies. And then they would rip through there. And I was mm-hmm. like, look, this has got to stop. Well, it stopped for a little while. And then it was like 11 o'clock at night. And the lights that light up my whole bedroom window as they're ripping by, and you can hear them coming.
Yep.
And then they dump into that creek and start ripping through there. I said, that's it.
Yep.
You guys are done. Now you're trespassing.
Mm-hmm. You know?
I mean, for the most part, most people are going to be friendly if you're respectful and courteous and, you know, you're a steward of conservation versus, you know, driving through with a vehicle and tearing up. I mean, think all the muscles and everything that they destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a pretty good rule of thumb for anything in life is don't be a jackass. And, you know, you get along with most people, you know, which that's lost on some people. I want to circle back again here a little bit to some foraging stuff because we didn't dive into that as much as I wanted to. And then we'll get you guys out of here because I don't want to take up too much of your time. But, Clay, foraging right now, like, obviously there's different growing seasons for different things. So what are you, like, what are you finding right now? What are you seeking out right now? Obviously, like, around us, morels is what everybody goes out and looks for. But I know there's obviously way more to it than just that. Mm-hmm. What are you looking for, like, this time of year? Where are you finding it, maybe, typically? And, I mean, just kind of let us in on that a little bit if you want to.
I mean, the spring is predominantly a time of greens, tubers, roots, you know, that sort of stuff. And like just for instance, like what I'm eating right now would be like a lot of Dame's Rocket, stinging nettle greens, wintercress, mm-hmm. just watercress. Just a lot of greens, and then as I mentioned before, the like wild parsnips have been on the menu a little bit. Jerusalem artichoke, mm-hmm. that's another one that's really really good. I mean, it changes throughout the season, so this is the season for me that I typically think of as greens time. You know, like you're just getting a lot of greens, and we like them cooked.
Okay,
you know, I'm not a fan of raw greens, and in fact the etymology for the word salad actually used to mean like cooked greens. So like a salad used to be like a bowl of cooked greens.
Destroyed that then, haven't we?
Yeah.
So do you mostly just steam everything, or do you
actually most wild greens are going to have way more nutrition than like any sort of green that you're going to get in the store. And with that nutrition, you're also going to get a lot more phytonutrients that are against herbivory. So they don't want you to eat them. So you can actually like blanch or slightly even boil most wild greens and still retain a ton of nutrition, way more nutrition than you would from store-bought greens. And still end up with a ton of flavor. And that's how I think they taste the best.
Personally,
I like to blanch almost everything. And that means getting boiling water going and then just throw a big handful of greens into that boiling water for like 30 to 60 seconds.
Right.
Pulling them out and eating them that way. They're delicious.
Okay.
So you don't own an air fryer is what you're saying.
No, I don't. Yeah. I love that. And then, mushrooms are good. I'm not a big morel fan, which everybody thinks is weird.
Mm-hmm. That's just because Clay doesn't have hardly any morel.
We have the freaking mushroom festival here. We have
they have something similar to that down here, but I don't think the same kind of mushrooms.
I would love to go to that festival. but I think for me, mushrooms are pretty good. But I end up like honestly just either selling or drying most of them because I got three kids. All three of them don't like mushrooms.
Okay.
So you know, it ends up being that like I'm not really like the hugest fan of them either. You know, like I eat them. I don't complain about it.
Right.
In fact, one of the things I say to all my kids is, who cares if you don't like something, just eat it anyway. You know?
Right.
So I'll eat mushrooms, but they don't. So we just don't end up eating a lot of mushrooms. You know, they're fun. They're fun to go pick. But plants are, they have a lot more nutrients. They're a lot more easy to find. They're more accessible to people. They, in my opinion, they're just as magical as mushrooms. It's just that,
especially if you smoke them.
Yeah, exactly.
I actually wondered if morels weren't also so popular because people know what they look like and they kind of know what they're looking for versus some other stuff. Mm-hmm. Like to a lot of people, I think just something green, oh, that's just a weed, and they look past it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that the morel is also popular though because of its scarcity.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So like if the whole forest floor was covered with morels, and everybody could find them,
it's like the 200-inch buck, right? I mean, it's not quite that scarce, but like there's that part of it, right? Like if you find it, you feel like you've done something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's probably.
I feel like the morels are some of the safest ones you could find, because even like a gyra mitra or a false morel, you know, like technically they're not the same. They don't look quite the same.
Right.
And that's like the closest lookalike that you really have, you know, and you get three different morel species around here that all of them are edible and they all look almost the same other than color.
Right.
You know, it's fairly safe.
Yeah. So you're not worried about them, any toxicity or anything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that even people are starting to push back on the whole idea that false morels are not edible. There's only some people are now, you know, like there was this thing like
rocket 10 years ago.
That false morels had the same chemical that was in rocket fuel.
Oh, okay.
And then it was gonna give you cancer, and it was this horrible thing. And now a lot of mycologists are kind of like pushing back on that idea and saying that's not true. But I know that actual false morels, though, I don't know exactly what species that is when people. Oh, Verpa bohemica.
Okay.
That's the false morel. That one is actually can make people sick. But the corphes and all those other false morels, gyromitras, I think those are all edible and safe to eat.
Okay. So I think maybe a lot of barrier to entry on the foraging thing would be people not knowing what they're looking at, or maybe they're worried about finding something that's going to make them sick. So how much stuff is there out there that really, if someone ate it, would make them sick? Is it like a high percentage of stuff? Like if you don't know what you're doing, it's like could be dangerous, or like is it a little easier to figure out than people think?
I think it's a lot easier to figure out than people think. And I would actually say that there's so much edible and medicinal stuff on the landscape that people just walk by every single day that it is definitely overstated, the concerns. I mean, it's good to be aware. You should always be aware of like not eating things, but most of the things are, if they're going to make you sick, it's going to be like a tummy ache.
Right.
And that's it. And, or maybe a little bit of the old D-read.
Which some of us probably need every now and then, flush out some of that McDonald's we've had three times a week or whatever.
Yep, exactly. So I don't know. It's overstated in my opinion. And it doesn't do us any good when there's movies like Into the Wild.
Yeah.
So like Christopher McCandless just starved to death, but the author, and that movie made it seem as if he was poisoned by a plant, but that's not even factual.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure that plays a big role too, but like I said, I don't want to take up too much more of your guys' time. We've been going for over an hour now, I think, but.
Oh, we'll chat forever.
I'm the same way. That's why I got to look at that's why I like this running clock in front of me. So
here's just a quick story though.
Okay. Yeah.
One of the most prominent foragers, you know, was author, everything. And so Sam Thayer was telling me a story one time, and he was talking about his hillbilly neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And these neighbors had no clue about foraging whatsoever, and they wanted to go out and pick a bunch of berries. So they went out, they tasted all these different berries, and they kept the ones that they tasted and tasted well. And they said, hey, we got these berries, and they brought them a basket of like 12 different varieties of berries.
Mm-hmm.
And every single one of them that they put in that basket turned out it was actually edible.
Really?
And that was just by taste alone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So there you go. Like I kind of figured it was probably that way. Like there's not as much hazard in it as it's made out to be, but I do feel like that's probably a lot of people's concern with maybe doing it is just not knowing, but.
Yeah,
and there's apps for that too, right?
Well, here's my thing. Always trust yourself and verify against the knowledge that you've gained.
Yep.
And then just use, like, say, I know what that is, but I'm like 98% sure. Yeah. And you use that app and the app says it's that, and you can follow that app with other research, then go with that.
Right.
But don't rely on those apps solely. Yeah,
for sure.
Because I've seen it completely tell you something completely different than what it actually is.
Yep. No doubt.
But I would like to add, just for safety's sake, that any new foragers stay away from the carrot family for a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. So that's the most dangerous, right? Like, and poison hemlock does grow all over Illinois, for instance, does grow all over Michigan, and poison hemlock can kill you in literally 3 hours. So you don't want to mess that one up with wild carrot.
Yep. Just forget.
No, probably not.
Yeah. Just let's stay away from that one, huh?
Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
No, that's good. You guys got any?
I still don't mess with like chervil or anything like that, because it's still so close, especially in the young stages. It looks very similar to hemlock, and I don't know the difference.
Right.
So yeah. I just stay
it's not worth it
myself. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you guys, are you guys picking any ramps yet?
Are we picking any what?
Ramps?
Mm-mm.
Or Allium tricoccum? Mm-mm. Or Burdickii?
No. I plan on it tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah. So, wild leeks, right?
You know, okay.
They're probably all over by you. If you guys got morels right now, you've definitely got those.
Okay.
And my whole thought process with the whole trout season was that I want to get a couple trout. I want to take them and smoke them. And then after I smoke them, get some wild ramps and some other things, and like maybe some cut leaf toothwort, put all those together in a trout salad and have like a smoked trout salad sandwich.
There you go. I like it.
You have a plan.
I like it. Well, you guys got anything else you want to hit on or leave them with? And even if not, go ahead and tell everybody where they can find you guys at. Hey, everybody, I appreciate you tuning in for another episode. If you don't already, go over to Instagram and Facebook and give us a follow at Ridge Hunter Outdoors. We also have a private Facebook group called Ridge Hunter Nation, where you guys can have some input on the show. You can ask us questions. You can ask upcoming guests questions. You can tell us who you want us to have on and what you want us to talk about. And on top of all that, just use it as a regular hunting group. Share your stories, your success, pictures, your failures, whatever it is. That's all at Ridge Hunter Nation on Facebook. Our website is ridgehunteroutdoors.com. That's where you're going to find more info on the consulting and management services that we provide. We also have the podcast posted on the website with some other content as well. And we have our merchandise and our food plot seed. And if you find any of that stuff that you want, make sure you use the discount code RHOPOD. That's all caps, no space. And you get 10% off your entire order there. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or anywhere else that lets you do so, make sure you rate and review. That helps us, and give us a follow there too. YouTube, our channel is Ridge Hunter Outdoors. You can subscribe to that. Hit the notification bell so you know when everything comes out. The podcast will be posted there, as is our Fall Pursuit show, which we'll have more of coming up next season. You guys can go back and rewatch everything that we did this year. We had 10 episodes on that. We're hopefully going to do some turkey hunting this spring. And, of course, we'll have all our off-season content on YouTube as well. So thanks to everybody who already does follow and subscribe. If you don't, make sure you go do that. Now let's get back to the episode.
Well, I would personally love to plug my YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go for it, dude.
First and foremost, which is Foraging the 50. We're not there yet, but we're slowly accumulating channels. States, I mean. And it's an episode in every state. I meet up with a forager in another state, and then we film an entire episode of us going out and finding just a few basic foods in each state and then making a meal.
Cool. Cool.
And then, yeah.
It's actually a great show. It doesn't belong on YouTube. It actually needs a network.
It's
actually really, really well put together.
When you said that when you just described it, I thought that should be on like the Discovery Channel or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. What about you, Luke? You want to plug anything?
Well, the podcast, obviously.
For sure.
Publicly Challenged. You can find it on Carbon TV. You can go there. So if you got a smartphone, smart TV, whatever your computer, you can go to Carbon TV on the app. App is free. Download that app. You can stream all kinds of TV shows. And on top of that, you can listen to this lovely podcast called Publicly Challenged with Clay and myself and whatever guests we typically have on at the time. And if you can't find it there, you can also go on any of your other streaming platforms, Spotify, iTunes, whatever. It'll be on there as well. And then, of course, publiclychallenged.com. mm-hmm. with all of our wonderful t-shirts, stickers.
Heck yeah.
Support the podcast, buy those things, or else I'm going to shut it down.
Oh, oh, and then I am Clay Bowers on Instagram and Facebook, and pretty easy to find.
Okay, so. Cool. Yeah, I'll link all that stuff in the description too, so it'll make it easier for people to find. But if for Sweet. Sure, go check that stuff out, you know, if you're listening to this. These guys are, they put out a lot of good content. I've been consuming it for a while now. not, no pun intended on the foraging thing. But no, it's interesting stuff. And like I said, even if you're someone who's not, like, if you don't think you're into foraging, like, it's fun to listen to you guys talk about it and the stuff that you enjoy doing. And then I think you guys are surely getting a lot of new people into foraging. Like, there's no way you're not.
Hopefully. Yeah. I know Clay has for sure.
Yeah.
But the one thing I want to add to that is just if you're just a hunter and you go out there, you're not fully participating in nature. Mm-hmm. And by becoming more aware of the landscape, you never go home empty handed. There's always something there, and the season, everything, it never ends. Mm-hmm. Once you become an animal and a hunter and a forager, it's year round. And I mean, it's so fulfilling. Now, to eat all that and you're actually nourishing your soul.
Yeah, mm-hmm. for sure. Hey, that's as good a place to end it as any that I can think of. So I appreciate you guys coming on with us tonight. It's been a lot of fun. We've had a lot of laughs. We've covered a lot of ground too. So that was good. That's something I like about not necessarily having a plan. You just never know where you're going to go. But thanks again, you guys. Keep up the awesome work over there. We'll be staying tuned in and everything. And again, just thanks for taking some time out of your evening for us.
Absolutely.
Much appreciated. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
See you guys.